We started developing craft, and to make things a little shorter here, we developed small bench models that we were operating natural principles with, and one of which I was involved with. We had a bench model, and we had it attached to an audio amplifier similar to that I had. It's a little more fancy than the one I had, but the one I had on the 15-inch speaker that I levitated with. And it started vibrating this disc. It's a 3-foot disc. And I touched the outside of the disc, and it was solid aluminum. And I kept feeling the hum. The whole room seemed to kind of hum. And I kept touching it, and pretty soon it got soft like jello. And pretty soon I put my fingers in through the aluminum hull of this craft, on this little ship. And Carr just winked at me. He said, nothing. You know, he... And we got into some pretty far-out conversations about what life is and everything. And he said, we're going to be doing the big craft pretty soon, and you have to get familiar with these laws and what they are. First, you have to realize that we're living in a world of illusion, that everything is energy, including you and me and the deep blue sea. It's all energy. And we perceive of it in nanoseconds. We produce it with our retinas and create what we want to create. We're all creators, and we create our environment. And I said, well, yeah, but... And he said, no, there's no buts involved here. This is the way it is. There's a realm beyond belief. He said, the realm of belief, if you believe something, you can be convinced not to believe it. And it's called the world of duality. You get into this is black, this is white, this is red, this is... And he says it goes on and on forever in a box. It's like you're chasing your tail, and you don't really get anywhere.
Okay, so he was telling you something that just seems a little hard to comprehend. That nobody's real and everybody's real at the same time. We're all energy of some sort, and our retinas transpose it. Did I get it kind of right?
That's it.
Okay.
That's it, yeah.
Well, that is hard to take.
You got it. So anyway, he said, well, now we're going to try and introduce this to the public. We've got General Motors on the phone. They agreed to meet us down in Riverside, California, for a talk and a demonstration of what we'd like to present to them. And I went down with Mr. Carr and a couple of the engineers. And when we got there, they had their engineers there, and they were all set up ready to see what we had. And we told them we wanted to take their wheels that were vertical, that was having to put down a lot of pavement for them to transport people in order to get somewhere. And we wanted to take their wheel and turn it sideways and get it off the ground. That way we wouldn't destroy any more of the earth. We wouldn't have to put down concrete.
Right. No more juggles.
Yeah, right. So, and we gave him a small demonstration of levitation.
Uh-huh.
And we showed him it's quite simple. There's nothing to it. And we want to ask you guys if you will help us manufacture spaceships for everyone. And he said, are you serious? And I said, yeah. And he said, do you realize magnetic power? We explained it to him. No such thing as accidents. And that in the craft that we
were... How does that work?
Well, if you played with magnets at all, you know that if you turn them one way, they attract. If you turn them the other way, they repel. And that's the nature of magnetism. It has an attraction and a repelling forces to it. So in the case of spaceships... And this was before computers really got going. Now there's nothing to it. But if you get into a craft and you have a magnetic field that you're in, like a bubble of a bubble, you can't crash. You can't crash into anything. You can't crash into each other or anything else.
In other words, when it gets close, it repels it.
It repels it.
Okay.
And with the advent of computers now, which can think faster than the brain, it's absolutely perfect, because there are no accidents. Well, he said, do you realize what the insurance company is going to be saying about this? No more money for insurance. No more. No. You guys are going too far out, too soon. I said, maybe 100 years. He was telling us the same thing that I'd heard before.
Yes. So in many ways, these guys were protecting their turf.
Yeah.
But they're really guilty of some sort of manslaughter, if you stop and think about it. Look how many automobile accidents we've had all these years. You look at all of the danger we've done to the ecology by still staying with fossil fuels. It's criminal.
Yes.
I understand they're talking about that they're just looking after the economy and the way they're doing it. But that's not all. There's always unintended results and consequences. And the unintended consequences is that hundreds of thousands of people have died over the years needlessly.
Yes. I never looked at... Thank you for that. I never really comprehended that till just now. But that's true. They are responsible for many, many things that didn't have to happen after we gave them the option of a better way, of an easier way.
Right.
Either easier way. He said, yeah, that'll probably work, but yeah. We're not interested. And I'll tell you what, Mr. Carr, if you put them up, we'll shoot them down. That was the exact words this guy said. If you put them up, we're going to shoot them down. So we were stunned, and we didn't know what to say, you know, how to react to that. So Mr. Carr, he was a very humble gentleman, and he just said, well, you know, it's going to happen sooner or later, and the later it gets, the more trouble, the more chaos, the more harm is going to happen. And we could end all this right now if you'd let us proceed. And he didn't want to hear anymore, and he left the room. That was the end of that interview.
So you once again hit a blank wall.
Hit another blank wall. So Mr. Carr said, all right, boys, we're going to have to get a larger model. We had a 45-foot craft that we had just got operational, got everything ready to operate. And he said, what we'll do is get this thing operational, and we will then take it and show the public. We'll spot all over the place with this thing and more. We were going to build more and let the public see
what's
going
on. Right, in other words, bypass.
Yeah, bypass
yeah.
This system.
These people that were standing in your way.
Right. So we did. We hurried up then. We worked day and night, and we got this 45-foot craft ready to go, operational. But before we could do anything, Carr said, now, boys, it's time for the briefing. And this is where we're gonna go a little further out than you've ever been before. And I'll explain all to you about this part of natural law. And that is where you're going to go. We've got a 65-mile range here in Victorville. And you're going to go down range about 10 miles. I'm going to have you get out and do some things, and then you're going to come back. And that's it. That's the end of the experiment. I got into my job, and we modified and changed many of the existing technologies. And then they came up with a mask, a wraparound mask that was my baby. I had to find a way to perfect this mask without distortion that would go down and withstand 200-300 foot depths, so that you could see without distortion. So we went out for...
Sounds like you did pretty good with that, going to engineering school.
I seem to be progressing along. Just, you know, I don't know how I did it, but I did.
Right.
And I was always inventing little things for them, how to control their products and their consumer goods and everything. And so they called me in one day, and they asked me if I would consider being a head diver on a Calypso 2 that they were going to put on the Pacific coast. The Calypso 1 was on the eastern coast. And I said, well, sure, when? They said, well, it'll be a year or two, but we'll keep you in mind. Well, the voyages out to Catalina Island and beyond were getting more and more extensive. The diving was getting deeper and deeper. I had a couple of close calls out there in diving. And my wife...
By close calls, you mean you went too deep or whatever? Or?
Well, I had forgotten. I thought my tank was full. I had good, big tanks.
Well, that's something you wouldn't want to forget.
No. But I thought they were full because when I checked the gauges, they said full. But when I went down over 250 feet, which requires a hangout on the way up so you can decompress. And I suddenly realized I was getting very low on air.
And you couldn't hang out much.
I couldn't hang out much, so I came up just exhaling.
They get your bends?
No, I never got them. Yeah, I was lucky enough to get up fast enough, and I got out of there. But when my wife heard about it, she said, no, that's it. The kids want a dad, and you need to be closer, and you're getting into too much danger. And I found an ad
In
here.
Other words, the wife put the foot down.
She sure did. She stomped me. So she found an ad in a paper that was from Advanced Kinetics in Costa Mesa, California, that was advertising for a laboratory technician. And she said, why don't you go down and apply for that? And I said, well, I got no credential, no academic. I'm heavy weapons man in diving, that's all. And she said, no, you're tinkering, which I used to do 24/7 in the house. Mm-hmm. I was always tearing something apart. And my fundamental interest in life has been magnetics, magnetic power, and anything to do with magnetics. So she said, go down and put in an application. So I went down, and it was at lunchtime, and nobody was in the hostess and everything were out to lunch. I walked down the hall, and I went by the director's office. His name was Dr. Weinhardt. And he said, what are you doing? And I said, I'm looking for a job. And he said, well, come in. They're out to lunch. Sit down. What's your credentials? I said, I learned how a bumblebee operates. He said, what do you mean? I said, well, I was on the second floor of the science class at Santa Cruz High School when my physics teacher, he was teaching physics, was saying bumblebees don't aerodynamically, they can't fly. And at that moment, I looked out the window, and there was a bumblebee hovering right, looking me square in the eye. And I had to make a decision to go back to my natural life, which was learning from nature, or listen to this guy that said it can't be done. There's no such thing. Well, later on, I found out both was true, that bumblebees technically don't fly, but bumblebees do levitate. And
oh, really?
Yeah.
I mean, it's because that's a question that every high school science teacher brings up.
Well, I learned it from Arthur Aho, who was a brother of Wayne Aho, who worked with us with Otis Carr in Apple Valley. And he wrote a book, Tomorrow's Energy Need Not Be Fuel. And in that book, he explains how bumblebees levitate. And there's a little hollow cavity next to their larynx that once they start the beat of their wings, they start increasing the frequency until they match the surrounding frequency, and in this case, the Earth's frequency at 8.5 cycles. And once they reach that frequency, this waves go back and forth in this cavity, and they resonate. And they reach what you could call a zero point. They nullify the gravity around them, and they create their own force field around them, and they become a free agent from gravity. And I later learned that hummingbirds and some lizards, there's a lot of animals that do this already. They actually operate on a different natural law than we talk about.
And I have a hunch this is going to come in handy later in your life.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. The reason I say that, we're going to take a break, and we'll be right back and find out how we get to bumblebees to zero-point energy and going from point A to point B in nothing, actually, nanoseconds, I guess.
Yep, nanoseconds.
We'll be right back. I'm Jerry Pippin. Don't go away.
The debate still wages. Did an alien spacecraft crash outside Roswell, New Mexico in 1947? The most concise and complete series ever broadcast on Roswell, direct from Roswell. Check it out on the UFO Files on JerryPippin.com.
It looks like it's about 8 or 10 miles
west. We're here with Ralph Ring, and maybe, in fact, many of you have watched the video of Ralph and the interview that Kerry Cassidy and Bill Ryan did. So you have a general idea where we're going, but for me, this is very interesting. In fact, Ralph, I had not realized that's how the bumblebee did it.
Yeah, that's the way they do it.
Yeah. So we're going over the background of Ralph Ring so you can understand what we're going to be talking about here in a minute.
Well, it was my
interest. So did the guy give you a job?
Oh, yeah. I told him, I said, I learned most of my stuff from lizards and birds and bumblebees and stuff. And we talked for quite a while about natural law. And every conventional law that he brought up, I could counter with a natural law that would work, where his ideas were coming short of an operational completion. And one of which was live water coming down a hill from a mountain. Nature neanders it and refreshes it every 2 feet with nitrogen and oxygen. And when man transports water, he does it in a straight line down a viaduct, and it's all dead water. There's mm-hmm. nothing. There's nothing. Life. Fish don't even like it. They jump out of the water. They don't like that kind of water.
So they got to breathe.
Huh?
Fish have to breathe.
Yeah.
They can't do that with dead water.
And they need that nitrogen. They need uh-huh. the life forces. So anyway, he said, okay, I'll tell you what. I said, well, I haven't even filled out an application. He said, no, we'll do that later. Last week, my man working on magnetics happened to leave, and it's just coincidence that you showed up and your interest is in magnetics. I'm going to put you on the magnetic project. I'm to work tomorrow morning.
This must have been a dream for you, dream job.
I thought, well, this is it. This is where I'm, going to feel pretty good. So they did. They gave me the job, and it was I had a workbench, and I had a giant oscilloscope with a high-speed Polaroid camera and a cathode ray tube that was firing electrons down through a magnetic field. And my job was to get from point A to point B without deflection. And so that's all you have to do. And I sat there day after day taking hundreds, if not thousands, of pictures of these silly electrons being deflected to either the positive mm-hmm. or the negative side of the magnet. So I was getting kind of bored because they were telling me to just keep giving it as much force as you can. You've got to get this going because we're working on a project for the government. This was by the way, this is a government-funded research laboratory doing very, very quiet work that the government wanted them to do. He said, use as much power as you want. Well, I took that into consideration. Then I looked over on the next bench, and they were working on levitation. They had these giant coils and, iron coil with mm-hmm. copper windings.
Right.
And they would levitate steel balls for about 8 minutes and burn up the coils because they they put too much power to them, and they just shorted out. And they didn't worry about it because they could go to supply and get another one. And these were about $400 a piece, and this was in about 55. That was
a lot of money, right.
But they said, don't worry about it. We've got plenty of money. So I was curious about that. And I had, through my interest in nature, found many other ways to do things, one of which was levitating and one of which was getting things to work without force.
So are you talking like the bumblebee example?
Okay,
something like that.
Where you don't have to propel the bumblebee through space. It just levitates on its own frequencies. It creates its own frequency and resonates
environment. So back in your mind, you were probably thinking, these guys are wasting a lot of time.
I did. I did indeed. So to make a long story short, I went home and tinkered around, and I built a miniature setup that I had at work. I had a cathode ray tube, and I took it out of an old TV and magnets. And the thing I did was what I learned from nature neandering the water down through a gorge that I used to frequent when I was a kid. And all I did differently was pulse the signal. In other words, I allowed the electron to spiral. It spiraled from negative and positive, never touching each one, but it went all the way through to the target. The first time and every time thereafter, for about 20 or 30 more times, I never had any trouble. So I took pictures of that. I wrote up the experiment. And then I got on the levitation thing. I took a 15-inch woofer speaker and put it on the carpet in my living room floor, attached an audio amplifier, started increasing the acoustics, the sound waves, and I finally wound up with a ping pong ball. And I went up to about 28,000 cycles and found that the ping pong ball would suspend itself in this 15-inch.
In other words, at a 28,000 cycle tone, the ping pong ball was levitated.
Right. I'm not sure of the exact frequency. It might have been 29, it might have been 27, but it was around there somewhere.
In that area.
And so, as usual, it was late, and my wife said, come to bed, and I left it overnight. When I woke up in the morning, it was still levitating.
So it's longer than the 8 minutes with the ball bearings they were doing.
Stayed there all night, no noise.
Right, right.
There wasn't any heat involved. There wasn't any of that. It was acoustical levitation, and I'd heard about the Tibetans using sound waves to raise rocks up the side of mountains and stuff. So it didn't sound impossible to me. It sounded very, very logical, or very possible anyway. So I wrote that experiment up along with the other, took pictures, went into Dr. Weinhoff's office, and I was expecting a raise. I thought he'd give me a raise and a promotion and everything. I thought, I solved your problem here on both of these things. And
I guess you didn't get a good reception because there's no need for more funding. Is that what we're getting to?
Well, he says I know what I didn't think you'd get there. He says I know it's that simple. I know what you're doing. He was a PhD. He was a very famous German scientist. He said, I know it's that simple, but this is a government-funded project, and they pay us to look for answers, not to find them. And that blew me completely out of the water. I just couldn't comprehend what he was saying. And he said, "Yep, that's the way it is. This is maybe down the line in 20, 30, 40 years, but he said this is not where we're at. I'm going to shred this, tell you to go back to work, and forget about this. Don't even talk about it. Just
wow."
So I was struck down to the ground. I couldn't believe that. I thought I was going to make my mark in life.
I mean, logic would tell you. Aha, I solved it.
Yeah.
But it was illogical because that's not what they were interested in.
No, and I explained to him, I said, now I just did this on my living room floor with about $50 worth of stuff. If we get those engineers in there to work on this and we get together, I think we can come up with some super stuff. And he said, nope, don't talk to them. I don't want you to do anything. So I went back to work. I worked 2 more weeks and I couldn't stand it. I quit. I couldn't take it anymore. That was the end of that.